Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students.
I want to see if the person can create the mood, that special sort of magical something at the beginning of that piece. But then on top of that, common sense and knowing how to deal with people. Mm-hmm. I think is really, really important. You know, understanding your situation. It's so much of what we do up there boils down having the common sense and the knowing what the other person is going through.
Yeah.
And being an advocate for the orchestra.
Yeah.
You want to
yeah.
make them succeed. That's mm-hmm. your job, is to make the orchestra succeed.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
Yogurt.
Yogurt. What kind of yogurt?
Yogurt. Noosa yogurt with chocolate sprinkles stuff.
Ooh, nice. my fiance gets the ones with where you like tip it over and it adds all the toppings in it. I love to get that one. Awesome.
And orange juice. I'm probably the rare commodity among conductors is I don't drink coffee.
Oh, yeah.
Like most people did. And let's see, I exercise a nice half hour in the treadmill.
Nice.
And I'm supposed to be conducting Dvorak 8, so I went through the second movement on the clarinet.
Oh, nice.
Which helps me figure out phrasing. And I mean, I've conducted the piece a lot, Dvorak 8. But I've also written a paper on it. But, you know, you visit great music and new ideas, new philosophies. And the most important one of which is that music is not a piece of paper.
Absolutely, yeah.
Music is sound, and dynamics in a vacuum are meaningless. So anyway, that's all stuff that I talk about and believe in more and more. The whole idea of pacing and people get hung up on stuff that's in the score and that I don't.
Yeah. Well, let's start there. I think we can jump in. welcome to Podium Time. We are here with Maestro Carl Topolo. Carl, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me.
Mm-hmm. So what did you discover this morning playing through Dvorak 8 on your clarinet?
Well, there's nothing like sitting down on the piano, I guess, to capture the whole picture. But even playing the lines on the clarinet and examining the direction of the phrasing and the pacing of the music, in other words, where something can move ahead or hold back a little, which is not written by the composer. And even though I've conducted the piece a lot, you still discover new things and can implement even new ideas and new philosophies that you may have about how the music can move, like I said, even when it's not written, how dynamics in a vacuum are meaningless unless you put them in context. Mm-hmm. So, and all of that gets incorporated, I think, into interpret, especially of a second movement, where this particular one, there is a lot of give and take, changes of mood, changes of character. So all that can be reflected in so many different ways that you go beyond the piece of paper in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
or the computer screen, if or your a tablet.
Yeah. Are you usually on the piano, and you just sometimes come to the clarinet, or is it, is that always something you use?
Oh, it's a combination of a lot of things, I guess.
Okay.
Well, I like to listen to my old recordings. In other words, if I've conducted the piece and I have a recording of it, I said, wow, I really like that. Or, gee, let me do this better. Or this tempo really wasn't what I should have been doing, quote unquote. So there are a lot of different ways. And I mean, unfortunately, there's no Dvorak recording, but I like to listen to recordings by the composers, if it's a Copland, a Stravinsky, Bernstein. Yeah. I think those are very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there must be some conductors from back in the day that at least knew Dvorak, right? That did some recordings.
Well, could be. I did a competition, an audition for a job many years ago, and one of the judges was somebody who actually had met Brahms.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
He was, I think, 90 years old or something, but he had met Brahms. Richard Laird, his name was.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it feels so old, but it's also like not that far in the past, right?
No. Either that or I'm in my 90s, which I'm not.
Perfect. Well, again, welcome to the podcast. We're so excited to have you here. Thanks so much for reaching out after our live stream a couple of weeks ago. I would have been wanting to reach out for a while, but it's you know, there's that kind of little bit of like starstruck, like, oh, is it time? Are we ready? But I'm really glad you reached out to us. And and you took this. So let's ask about this book that you have coming out. You've been planning this for a couple of years. Give us the backstory of that and how this is coming to fruition.
Sure. Over the years, I've written articles about pieces I've conducted a lot, and they're on my website now. And they are not scholarly dissertations. They are practical experiences I've had with pieces that, like I said, I've conducted a lot, and I've taught a lot also. And then I had an article on auditioning, article on pops concerts, rehearsing. So I just took this opportunity of having time now to sort of put it all together. And my stepbrother and stepsister are both, well, my stepbrother's a published author. And he said, listen, if you're going to do this, this is how you have to present the book. You just can't say I'm doing a book. You have chapter summaries. You have a reason for doing the book. You have a reason why this is different from other books. Mm-hmm. And so he helped me with that format. And the peer review people, when I submitted it and who thought it was a good idea to go ahead with the book, were really helpful, too. Two or three subjects, which I hadn't thought of, were really terrific ideas to add to the book. And I just discovered when I stopped to think about it, I've been assistant conductor of a full-time orchestra, founding conductor of a pops orchestra, conductor of a regional orchestra, founding conductor of a pops a youth orchestra, founding conductor of a pops youth orchestra, conductor of a chamber orchestra, conductor of a conservatory orchestra, and conductor of a summer festival. And so the guy said, why don't you put all that together, those sort of different experiences, the things that are in common to all and the things that are different. So that was a unique perspective that I really hadn't thought of. And I put a huge chapter about that, which turned out to be interesting for me just to reflect on the different approaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very rare combination of perspectives. Like I can't think of maybe opera or ballet are the only ones that you didn't mention, but like,
well, actually
everything.
I didn't. Those are actually opera, ballet, and also a professional brass ensemble. So I've been really fortunate to have a lot of experiences, and also jazz clarinet player.
Yeah. So you've got every one of them.
Well, some for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was wondering if we could just kind of go through the chapters, because You sent us the table of
Table of
contents.
contents,
So
exactly.
yeah, what I'm looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it I mean it kind of goes from the beginning through, from just, I mean, even getting started and finding a school with the right program all the way through your pops concerts, your music director roles, auditioning, musicians and everything. So let's talk about getting started for conductors. What do you think, if we have listeners out there who are just at the beginning of their conducting journey, what does that look like for them?
Well, I think there are two main things. Number one, do you have the stuff that it takes to do it? Do you have the talent, the ear? Do you have the interpersonal leadership qualities that people are going to rally around? Do you have common sense, which I think is just about probably 90% of what I do relies on knowing how to treat people in a way where they're going to rally around you and be supportive of what you're doing. And so there's, I have a list of those. Plus, what are the reasons of wanting to become a conductor? And if the reasons are for your own self-worth, or your own self-aggrandizement, or that you just want to be in power, then those are bad reasons. But if you truly love the symphonic repertoire, if you want to break past the limitations, let's say, even of your instrument, of whether you can play a spiccato successfully, whether you can find a reed that works, whether your lips are buzzing tomorrow, there you go beyond that. You look at the big picture of not just your instrument, but everybody. How does this all sort of mesh to be something that you're really excited about, and you're willing to do the hard work? Because when you stand in front of a group of people, you're being judged from the minute you stand up there, whether you like it or not, whether it's a elementary school band or full-time professional orchestra. You're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position, so you have to have the stuff. I mean, when I was studying in New York, my teacher, he was tough, and I took the philosophy, well, if he's tough with me, maybe he sees something. I don't know if I could do it now, but back then I was pretty resilient, and he would really get on my case, yet unbelievably helpful in the long run. And so it's just a lot to go into it, but just knowing why you're doing it, I think, is really important. Do you want to bring symphonic music to young people? Do you want to explore a certain kind of repertoire that hasn't been done? Is there an underserved portion of the community that you'd like to serve? So, and then, the whole idea of being a self-starter too. Well, the world isn't going to come to you. You better go ahead and do something. I have a section of the book. I hope people find it funny. It's called Carl's Clichés. And one of my favorite is one of the ladies who plays in the Cleveland Pops is teaches at the local high school string program. And she said, if you don't want to move chairs and stands, if you're not willing to move chairs and stands, don't become a conductor. I thought it was a funny bit of advice. So that's one of Carl's clichés.
I love that, or Boeing parts.
You're right. If you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. If you're late, you're fired, et cetera, et cetera. So there are more. One of the ones that I know I made up is, what's the difference between a professional and a professional? A professional arrives at rehearsal prepared, knows all the foreign language terms, and is on time. A professional hasn't done his or her homework, arrives at the last minute before the downbeat, and hasn't really done any work or research to find out what the music is about. So that's a professional and a professional,
Love
et
it.
cetera. And the list goes on.
I love that you start the book with what's the purpose behind you wanting to become a conductor? Because I think a lot of young people want to be conductors. And then once we start conducting, and I know I have this experience, we realize that it's not quite what we thought it was. You know, you have to be a lot more of a servant than a I mean, leadership, yes, we're a leader, but it's a lot more complex than that. And I'm wondering what it, for you, what was your kind of mission as becoming a conductor? What drew you to it initially?
Well, I always liked the big picture,
yeah.
You know, and I hate fussing with reeds and mouthpieces and bells. Some clarinetists just love it, you know. Yeah. They try 50,000 reeds, they try this brand, that brand, and that was not the least bit interesting to me. And I guess I was conducted by people, and I said, well, I think I could do just as well as that person, which is a terrible way to think, maybe, but I really believed that I had something to offer and believed in myself to the degree that I really wanted to pursue it and see what I could do. But it's really always was all about the music and the big picture and the great masterpieces of music that, you know, when I was 15, I bought these scores. They're called arrow scores. So they pointed to the whoever has the melody. There was an arrow there.
Yeah.
And so I put on the 33 and a third LP, and I played along with the different parts. And I became, obviously, transposition is such an important part of what we do. So playing all these parts on the clarinet was really, really helpful to transposing and understanding. I think maybe every conductor has sort of an epiphany moment, which may not be a good one. when I was 20, which is just a few years ago, I was in a rehearsal. Conductor came and looked at the parts, and he said, these bowings aren't very good. And I was playing clarinet in the orchestra, and I said to myself, I would know a good bowing from a bad bowing. And there are a lot of people out there dependent on you. You better figure this out. So in my usual fashion, I decided to learn a string instrument. And I took up the viola, which I thought was good not only to play a string instrument, but also help you with the clef. So you could become a little more comfortable with the alto clef. And so, you know, I never really played very well. But I got to the point where I could sort of play the Telemann second movement. So I thought that was a step. And then my two daughters both studied violin. So I work with them and I do my own bowings now. And if I feel that I don't quite get it, I'll always go to somebody to help me. And so, this doesn't quite, you know, I think I need a little help to figure out what to do with this place or that. So, but that was unbelievably helpful. And I make a point throughout this book that you may not be a string player, but you better know what to tell the people. Even if you don't do your own bowings, you have to understand why a bowing is being used, why the violin is playing on this string and not that string, and all the other things. How anyone ever plays the bass is a miracle to me, but that's another story.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's a great example of the go-getter attitude that you mentioned earlier. It's like, you know, I just got to learn this, so let's dig down and
learn it. Yeah, I had another unfortunate thing when I discovered I wanted to be a conductor. I really hadn't much piano skill at all. So when I was 19, I decided to learn the piano, which is really late. So for 5 years, I practiced maniacally on the piano. And another point I make in the book is that I think every conductor needs to have some piano skills. And this past year, I've been playing the piano literally every day and have been mainly to get some more technique. But I've been having fun because I've been playing popular standards, Gershwin, Porter, just really being able to sit down on the piano. Because now if I see a piano, I can go sit down and play it. Which before I said, well,
yeah.
I'm going to leave this to somebody else. But now, okay, I'll sit down and play whatever, Bye Bye Blackbird or Someone to Watch Over Me or whatever number of tunes. And that, I'm enjoying that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, I know me and my regular conducting teacher, this seems to be the year of conductors sitting down at their pianos for the first time in a long time.
Well, for me, it really paid off. I mean, it really paid off when I had an audition with the Cincinnati Symphony. We had to play the and conduct, or it was a while ago, do something with the third act of La Boheme. So I did a simplified version on the piano and sang all the parts, or the vocal parts rather. Yeah. And so it really, really paid off. So I was very fortunate. And that was for Thomas Schippers, who was one of the, I think it was a protege of Bernstein, one of the really great American conductors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was, something that was very helpful in the long run.
Going back to the book, I'm really interested in the second chapter, the finding the right school for you, or finding the right conducting program for you. What's your summary of that advice for young conductors?
Well, advice number one is, I don't believe in undergraduate conducting degrees.
Okay.
So I think, though, picking a school is, you have to sort of really examine what you're looking for. I went to Manhattan School of Music and took academic courses that teachers were brought in to teach whatever, history, English, et cetera. Some people want a little more well-rounded liberal arts background. So you might go to a college that has a good music program, for example. Well, my daughter, who did not major in music, went to Bowling Green State University. And she played an orchestra for 4 years. She's a psychology major, marketing minor, but she enjoyed playing music. And that's one of the reasons we went there, and they had there's a very nice music program. So maybe that's better for an individual, or they may want to do to an Ivy League school and get a different sort of approach. You didn't, Yo-Yo Ma, I think he went to Harvard, for example, or other well-known conductors have gone to, prestigious schools. So it really depends on what kind of background you're looking for. But once you get past that and you want to go to graduate school, I outline my program that I taught at Cleveland Institute of Music for many years, what I'm looking for, not only as a musician, but also as a personality. Yeah. That's outlined in there. And I also talk about the conducting exam that I give, and how in the Tchaikovsky Serenade or the Wagner Siegfried und Roy, I always planted a wrong note. I had one guy who did an audition. He had no scores, and he did his whole audition without a score. Great. Well, he never heard
to be a conductor.
Yeah, but he never learned. But he never heard the wrong note.
Yeah.
And if you don't hear it the first time, I'll actually go back on some pretense and say, well, let's do this again. So they get to hear it again. Still didn't hear it. So, and I thought that that's sort of an interesting part. Also, opera recitative, I think, is really reliant upon a conductor. An orchestra can save you a lot, but it usually can't save you very easily from a opera recitative. So yeah. That's the part where you really have to know your stuff. And so I talk a lot about, what my program was like, and what one could look for in a program too, in terms of podium time is like always number one. Everyone talks about got to have podium time, which I totally agree. But make sure when you stand on the podium that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And another point that I make in my book is I actually have a section about some videos that you can refer to on my website. And I talk about various conducting techniques that I use and how they've helped me. But I constantly remind people that the stick technique is the tip of the iceberg. If you don't have this vast knowledge underneath, then it doesn't matter what you do with your hands, with your arms. If you don't know the instruments of the orchestra, if you don't know how to talk to people, you don't know how to rehearse, if you don't know how to program, if you don't know any number of things. And to me, my students, there are times where I've been appalled what they don't know about the instruments of the orchestra, really. And I can't stress enough, If you're going to tell an oboe player to play pianissimo in a low C, it's not going to happen, you know? So I give a lot of practical example. Here's an example that comes to mind right away. There's a place in the Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet. There's a little quartet with two clarinets, English horn and bassoon. The English horn, they're all marked piano or pianissimo. English horn and the bassoon are in the very low register. And clarinets in the low register. So rather than harp on the bassoon and the English horn to play quietly or quieter, have the clarinets play a little louder.
Yeah.
You know, so we could find that equilibrium where the clarinets could play unbelievably softly in a low register, but the English horn and the bassoon, there may be a finite level that they can reach. So a lot of these sort of practical ideas of how to tune a chord, how the what string to play on, bow distribution. I mean, it's just an infinite amount. And I also tell them, don't forget about the brass and the percussion. They need to be told more than you're too loud. There's a lot of nuance in those instruments as well. So again, it's all sort of practical ideas.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you mentioned an auditioning student that was an automatic no, like of course not. I'm not interested in working with this person. Could you talk about a couple examples or what it's like when you see somebody, what qualities make you say, yes, absolutely. That's somebody
sure.
I'd like to teach.
Well, another funny example, just to go back to I like to dabble in foreign languages. I speak, I've worked a lot in Italian, Spanish, French, German. I've rehearsed them. And it's like one of the coolest things. I really enjoy it a lot. So I had one guy and he would have to be Italian. So, you know, he'd talk a little bit and he's talking to me in the familiar. You just don't do that. You know, I'm not your buddy yet. And I never will be. I had another student who was Italian. And now that was like 10 years ago. And we just agreed now that he could say ciao to me or talk in the familiar. So it's just, you know, little things that happen. I'm sort of looking more at the sort of the negatives and the positives. But the positives, basically, you know, when someone does the conducting audition, they have to understand that the piece that I used the third movement of the Tchaikovsky Serenade for Strings, Larghetto Elegiaco. And I want to see if the person can create the mood, that special sort of magical something at the beginning of that piece. And the same thing with the Siegfried and Dill. Can they find the glow of the music? Can they really figure out what to do? And I've even, you know, I'm just looking at the negatives because this happens too much and people need to know to be prepared. I mean, the Siegfried and Dill is marked Ruhig Bewegt. Okay. I've had kids who travel thousands of miles to do this audition and they don't know what Ruhig Bewegt means. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling that, you know, it's like being illiterate in music. But sorry, Jeremy, let's go back to the positives, okay? Having, this sense of understanding the mood of the character of the music. There's a part in the Tchaikovsky where the tempo moves ahead inexorably. It just builds and builds and excitement and sequences. And if the person just stays in tempo and doesn't feel that emotion, then that really isn't anybody who I think has that sort of inner sense of the emotion behind the music. And then after I let them get their sea legs, I'll let them conduct four minutes, let's say. And then I'll stop and I'll work with the person. And I'll find out whether the person is receptive to what I have to tell him or her. And how they respond to it. In other words, you say, well, can you try this? Let's do that. And it's either they don't improve or they resist or there really isn't anything happening. Then I know that this isn't a person who doesn't quite get it. And You know, you got to have a, you got to be, you have to have a really good ear to stand on the podium, and you have to have a real sense of the ebb and flow of music, of what an art, of what an appoggiatura does, how the tension of an appoggiatura then leads to a relaxation. And I don't know, it's just, I can usually tell in about 10 seconds, once they on the, even the way they walk to the podium, but that, we won't even go there. But once they're there and I see them conduct, and then I see if they can respond to what I tell them too. Yeah. They really understand what it's all about and whether they made the kind of preparation necessary. Another point I make in the book is when it's time for you to get in front of the ensemble, make sure that you've at least assembled a string quartet or a two or four hand piano to conduct the pieces and have a sense of comfort when you're standing there in front of these people. And I also make a bit of a point that the conductor is sort of like the CEO of a company. You want to create an atmosphere which is not toxic. You want to be approachable, but you want, you know, you're in the business of telling people what to do and being fair.
Yeah.
And do so with integrity. I mean, it sort of boils down to something very, very simple. And of course, your level of preparedness will dictate that actually happening. So anyway, a big portion of what I do, Jeremy, is I talk about rehearsing.
Yeah.
So I think rehearsing is really, really important. And without going into any detail, there are so many pitfalls in rehearsing and how important it is to develop a routine and an understanding of how to do it. I think it's important based either the level of the group, the number of rehearsals that you have, the expectations that you have, picking repertoire, which is playable by your ensemble. There's a lot of stuff that I go into, which hopefully the reader would find interesting and helpful.
I think so much of that is also just what you've been saying, just being prepared, just knowing the music and, you know, at least to a, you just got to know it. That's our job.
Yep. Yeah. But then on top of that, common sense.
Yeah.
And knowing how to deal with people, I think is really, really important. I mean, if you have X amount of time, you better make sure everything's rehearsed. And there are times that I've had to leave stuff go, but to make sure that the entire presentation was acceptable and maybe, okay, this, I wish I would have had time to work on this, but I don't. And another point that I make, which I do a lot before I start, if I have one rehearsal, which I unfortunately have a lot of situations, I'll say, okay, take a look at this, look at this, look at this. Let's try this. Let's try that. Take a look at this. Boom.
Yeah.
Then you play. But if you can bring certain difficulties in advance to the players, to their attention, and maybe rehearse one or two spots. I use Victory at Sea by Richard Rodgers suite, which I've done a lot. And I have the example. Okay, this is, I'll point out this, 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 and this. Let's try this. Let's try this. Point out this, point out that. And if I have time, try that. And then go through the piece. And then when it's over, say, okay, let's do this again, or watch out for this, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the rather than just say, let's start from the beginning, and then you get to the spot, which could have been avoided. The problem could have been avoided just by pointing it out, even a key change or a time signature or a twice as fast, twice as slow. There are all things that you can point out, which will help somebody. Okay, great. He mentioned this. Now I understand what I'm supposed to do when I get there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm so used to limited rehearsals, so I've worked very fast. I'm sorry, go ahead, Jeremy.
I think that lines up a lot with what you were saying earlier about being interested in the big picture. You know, I hate going and I do a lot of covering for other conductors, and I hate going in and you know, watching them rehearse. And you know, if we've got one or two rehearsals and time is running out and they're working on these tiny little details, then I'm like, but we haven't even finished the piece. Like, you need to do that transition later. Like,
yes.
I think
common sense, Jeremy, it's common sense.
Mm-hmm.
you know, understanding your situation. It's so much of what we do up there boils down, assuming you have the talent and the ear, having the common sense and the knowing what the other person is going through,
yeah,
and being an advocate for the orchestra. Your mm-hmm. job is to make the as I don't want to say easy or seamless or as comfortable as another bad word, because it'll never be comfortable, but to make it at least okay, they know that you're on their side.
Yeah,
you want
yeah.
to make them succeed. That's mm-hmm. your job, is to make the orchestra succeed.
Yeah.
Being their advocate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is only something I've kind of been working on in the past couple of years. But when I moved to my new teacher, one of the first things he said to me was, your job is that big picture. Your job is not the details. If they need to be addressed, then it's your job. But let the players do the details. You focus on the bigger things.
Yeah.
I was so into those details all the time. And that was something I really needed to hear at that moment.
Right. Well, also you have to know what stuff the orchestra can fix by itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
The player can see, you don't have to stop. And then accumulate two or three or four comments, you know, go through mm-hmm. 32 bars, whatever, and say this, 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 and this, rather than stop after four bars or three bars and do yeah. it. Also, I talk about when you stop at the end of a phrase.
Oh, yeah.
It's like interrupting somebody in the middle of a sentence. Let them finish. Because if you get to a major orchestra, they're going to keep playing. Mm-hmm. So you might as well get to the end of the phrase
mm-hmm.
before you stop them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, what – say we have – again, a lot of our listeners are kind of in grad school very early in their career. What's your advice for young conductors that are maybe just graduating or just graduated a couple years ago and are still very early in the job market?
Well, part of the issue, I think, is getting yourself known.
Yeah.
And I think there are times where either a master class or a seminar or a summer program, if you can get someone who could be your advocate later on, I think that can be helpful. And when you finally get your opportunity, whether it's an audition, just be just unbelievably prepared. And I don't mean just learning every note of the score, understanding, well, what might go wrong, or why is this difficult to play, or get a group together, like I said before, to go through the music. Or find someone who can help you with the practical aspects of what is going to be happening. And then, you know, what I talk about, I have a section called How to Win a Job, mm-hmm. dash, and How to Keep It. So I have sort of both ends of the spectrum that I like to talk about mm-hmm. as well. But what kind of advice is just, like I said, be super prepared. Seek out opportunities and become a self-starter. Find somebody who believes in you, who maybe can help you put together a concert or a series of concerts, or find friends who, if you're still in school, and buy them pizza and donuts, or if you have some money saved up, find a way you can pay them a small amount to play. I mean, I remember when I was getting started, putting together small programs and such, and so it's a daunting thing to do. And I really hadn't talked about this at all in the book, but having a plan B, a plan C too, you know, I thought I was going to work my way up through whatever, conducting this orchestra and then maybe move on to a bigger orchestra and a bigger one. Well, I wound up at the Cleveland Institute of Music. And I found out that working with college age kids is what I really love to do. Yeah. So that sort of became my focus, rather than sort of podium hopping from, you know, this one to that one to that one, working my way up, supposedly. And then I found out that the college age kids are just, you know, they're open-minded, they're talented, they're motivated, they're not jaded in any way, and they're not super judgmental, maybe. In a certain sense, And I felt this is what I want to do. And between CIM and National Repertory Orchestra, I got to work a lot with really talented, motivated college age kids and recent graduates. So that became my focus. And then Pops conducting came along, which turned about to be a big plus for me. And just been, fortunate, right place. Well, I like to say right place, right stuff.
Yeah.
Right time, mm-hmm. Right place, right stuff.
Yeah, it's
that one's good.
That's something we've talked about recently on the podcast also, is it's like there are lucky breaks, but you've got to be really ready for that lucky break.
Yeah,
it can just
say luck is the residue of hard work.
I love that. Yeah. National Repertory Orchestra, I'm not too far from there now. And I saw you do a concert a couple years ago. I don't remember which year exactly. You did a Shostakovich piano concerto, I think the second one. So let's talk about NRO and, how that's grown over the years, or what your relationship with NRO is. Because I know there is a conducting fellow position, isn't there?
Yeah, there had been. Right now we're sort of in between times. But some people I've had over the years, Victoria Bond was the first one, Alfred Savia, Mark Russell Smith, Robert Franz, Chelsea Tipton, Jason Siever, Ben Clemmy, Andres Solpera, Radu Papanai, Romanian guy. Anyway, I'm sorry, I don't know, but I can't pronounce his last name. Hey, we've had a lot of people who have gone on to really make their mark and conduct. I'm sorry, I've left out several of them along the way. Jose Luis Novo, who really have done very, very well. So that was an important part of the program. And now I'm in the role of music advisor, and Michael Stern's the new music director. And now our plans for the summer are evolving. We sort of have a focus, but we don't have an assistantship for this summer.
Yeah.
But hopefully when things get back to what we hope will be normal, that we'll be able to resume that. But it's been, I've had a really, Alex Amsel, who's with Fort Worth Symphony. I know I'm going to forget people. But I've had some terrific, and I really enjoyed working with them and attending their rehearsals and pointing things out to them and working closely with them. And I felt that was a really important responsibility. Stephen Smith, I told you, I keep forgetting people. So I just took this responsibility, really seriously. I'm not the sort of person who just says, here, go fend yourself against the wolves. So, but the NRO itself, as far as the players go, we've had to give a sort of experience, which has been an intense one. We do two full programs a week now. And we could do Heldenleben on Wednesday and Rite of Spring on Saturday. It's not uncommon to do crazy stuff like that. So that's what we've been doing for all these many years. I was music director for 42 years, assistant for 4 years, and now music advisor. So I've been there really a lifetime, and I've had the great opportunity to just give people the opportunity to grow as musicians, as orchestral musicians. And a lot of our alumni are playing in big orchestras or teaching, and even the ones who didn't go into music. And that's just fine by me. They say, I love that summer. It was terrific. I had a great time. Maybe I'm a lawyer now, or I've had people who are doctors. And I get lovely emails. I got an email from a fellow who's now a doctor. And he said, I just love my time with the NRO. It was just great. And so my mission, personal mission, is not to land people with major orchestras. My philosophy is to give people a great musical experience, which will also help them grow as individuals.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is where I'm coming from.
I love it. Love it. And it's nice to spend a summer in Breckenridge.
Yes, that's always been nice. But, the orchestra's had four homes. We started in Estes Park Excuse me, sorry, I didn't realize. Estes Park. Went to Evergreen, went to Keystone, and then since 93, we've been in Breckenridge. Mm-hmm. So that's been the exodus.
Perfect. Yeah, I had a great time going up. I got to go to a couple rehearsals and see a couple concerts. And
Sorry you didn't introduce yourself. I would've been happy to meet you.
Yeah.
Is that recent?
It was the year that Radu was the assistant.
Oh, okay.
So it was a couple years ago.
Yeah. Excellent.
I'll come up the next time, and because I'm in Denver now.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I remember, you know, when people make their presentations, or they send in their videos for consideration, and then we had live auditions.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking for somebody who knows, who can tell the orchestra something worthwhile.
Yeah.
And the whole rehearsing thing, I just think that people, just between the us and your audience, people get so hung up with gestures and how's the orchestra going to respond if I do this as opposed to this as opposed to that. Okay, great. There's no doubt that your physical qualities are important and interesting and need to convey something. But if you can't rehearse and if you don't have the foundation, I'm sorry to keep harping on that, but it's just really that starting point is just so important to know what you're doing. And if you get so hung up with gestures and that you don't know what an oboe does or a flute or a trumpet, anyway, or the general idea of how you put the music together. What's the pacing of the music? Where's the harmony, the melody? And there are a lot of musical points I make in the book also. I talk about the river and the leaf, which is also sort of an original concept. No, the concept isn't original. The terminology definitely is. The idea is if a leaf falls off a tree into the river, it gets swept away. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the river is never going to stop. So if you have a moving passage, something is quick, and there's a, let's say, an expressive passage or melody over it, it's got to stay with that. And one of my favorite examples, which most people I'm sure could identify with, is the last movement of the St. Paul suite. Okay, so the orchestra plays. Now, what happens when? When the green sleeves comes along, how do you make the two of them mesh?
Yeah.
So you stick with the river, which is da da dum pa da da di la da da dum pa da 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 ba ba da da di da da, and make sure that the leaf gets swept away with the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I have several examples of that, of the Debussy Afternoon of a Faun.
Oh, that's the one that came to mind for me, yeah.
Right. Be-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, de-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. That to me is the river. And be-da-dum, be-da-dee, that's the leaf. That has to be driven by this. So I have a bunch of examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I love
the imagery.
Points.
Yeah,
that's the best I could do. The river and the leaf.
Yeah, those motors are not going to slow down for you.
No, they really aren't. They find it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So is there anything else in the book that we haven't covered that you want to talk about before we move on to some of our more general questions?
Oh, well, I guess we could talk about auditioning.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have auditioning from both sides.
Mm-hmm. These are orchestral or conducting or what auditioning specifically?
No, actually, the audition is covered of the conducting audition is covered elsewhere.
Okay.
But the auditions as opposed to conductor is going to be going to be auditioning people mm-hmm. for his or her group.
I see.
So the idea is how are you going to what makes for a successful audition, and how do you listen, and how are they set up, you know, and then from the auditioner, sorry, the dog is in the background. Hang on a second. So it's essentially it's auditioning from both sides. What the conductor is looking for from the musician, plus how do you set up the audition with a room which is large enough, getting the notices out soon enough, what are you listening for specifically? But in addition, what kind of are you asking? Excerpts? If it's a young group, you're just asking a piece of your choice, maybe some scales. So all that. Then from the point of view of the person taking the audition, how that person prepares and how they what the person is going through, really, to take so the conductor has an appreciation of the preparation that's involved, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I have a section even on outdoor concerts. And anyway, maybe those are the main points that we've just talked about pops concerts. I talk a lot about. So anyway.
Yeah, and that's available. What's the available date for the book?
The availability is July 15th. However, with pre-order, you can save 30%.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so we'll definitely link to those, and that's the Orchestral Conductor's Career Handbook.
Correct.
Perfect.
Yeah, and if you go, you need to go through Roman and Littlefield. That's where you can get the discount.
Perfect. Awesome. Yeah. So we'll put that in the show notes and we'll share it
Excellent.
As well.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
And thank you. You know, thank you for putting together this book and you know, compiling all this experience and all this advice. I think it'll be very, very, very valuable.
Thank you.
Perfect. I was wondering, could we talk about your teachers a bit and some of the lasting lessons that you know, you still work on today from them?
Sure. We'll start with what to do rather than what not to do.
Okay.
Because there are plenty of those along the way. My conducting teacher, Leon Barzan, with the National Orchestral Association, that was quite a while ago, but he taught me how to conduct in a way, and I've never, whether it's dumb luck or using this technique, I've never been injured. I've never had any soreness. I've never had any problem whatsoever. Mm. And of course, your listening audience can't see this, but all the conducting that I do is a fulcrum from my elbow, in which the shoulder and the upper arm really don't move, but it all comes from the elbow through the arm. And I've been able to avoid injury. And also, this is an idea called center beating, where every beat passes through the center before going to the left, across, right, or up.
Yeah.
So Leon Barzan was amazingly helpful with the belly. I've really only had one lesson in my life on stick technique.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everything you always wanted to know and learn here, because it's all based on that. It's whether it's a small beat and fast, whether it's a slower tempo and a larger beat, it's all based on the fulcrum from your elbow. And that, you know, I've added things that I've learned. I've learned a lot of sort of technical things from Otto Werner Mueller, who was our guest conductor in Colorado many years. One thing I learned was that I've developed or myself, but I'm sure I've seen it from other people, is the fourth beat. One, down, two, center, and then left, three, crosses a plane, right. And then the fourth beat becomes a circle that hits the center. One, two, three, circle, hit the center, which is what I do an awful lot because I find one, two, three, four inherently is sort of weak.
Yeah.
But this, if you make a circle and hit, that's very, very strong. And I do a lot. And then three would be one, two, three. The third beat is a circle that hits the center as well. So those are outlined on the references on my book to my website. which for the moment is still up, but I have to take all that stuff down off my website once the book is out. Because unfortunately, I can't give it away for free.
Oh, yeah.
But it's still there now, Jeremy, if you'd like to take a look at what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. about these conducting techniques. From those point of view, I think those have been really, really helpful from a technical point of view. As far as influential conductors, Otto's ideas of phrasing and sound, I found real, and bowing even to some degree, to where the bowing serves the music. The music doesn't serve the bowing. And I even have examples of that in my book. But the idea of a musical line, of a musical phrase, of sounds connecting, of timbre, I think these things that were Otto was very, very big on, and I learned a lot from watching him. And then, you know, whoever I happen to be, if I go to a concert, a rehearsal, or something, and I always learn something. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
But those two, I think, were pretty important figures in whatever development I've been able to achieve.
Do you have any programs coming up? Do you have performances scheduled now?
Yeah, it's sort of slow in getting going again. I have actually a program I'm doing Thursday called Superheroes, and it's being done for it's only being recorded and being sent to schools with the Firewind Symphony. We have everything from William Tell, Robin Hood, Captain America, Avengers, Star Wars, Harry Potter, SpongeBob, Simpsons, sort of a funny amalgamation of music, probably more detailed than you really wanted. And we're doing a bunch of summer outdoor concerts with Firelands because about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, our building collapsed.
Oh.
It was very, very odd, but some sort of mini tornado. The only building on the whole street that was damaged, and half the building was destroyed. So we don't have a place to play at the moment, especially since high schools aren't letting you in. Mm-hmm. So our plan now is we have 3 or 4 summer concerts, and then we'll do a Christmas concert in a big sports complex, indoor, brand new, state-of-the-art, tons of ventilation, high ceilings, which I think will be very safe. And by December, hope we'll be okay. And then hopefully get into a high school. And they've just hired somebody to do the restoration of the theater. It's like a 1928 old movie house. It's a beautiful theater. And it's really we have this big, huge chandelier, and it was not destroyed. It got very close to the edge of where the roof collapsed. So that's what Firewind's doing. The summer programs, the Cleveland Pops has 2, hopefully 3 outdoor programs we're going to be doing. And then the fall will be starting in the middle of November. Mm. Hopefully it'll give things enough time to settle down, and we'll have our regular series of concerts. And then with the NRO, we'll be starting in June with programs. And hoping that everything can resume to something close to where we were, obviously all of us. This summer, it's a little bit up in the air, but I may be conducting the music for Charlie Chaplin movies.
Oh, cool.
Which I've never done before. I got to do E.T. and I got to do Wizard of Oz, which were wonderful experiences. I wouldn't trade that for the world. And but the Chaplin, obviously the music never stops.
Yeah.
You know, E.T., you can have a 5-minute dialogue and say, well, that's great, we'll just wait till the next musical cue.
Yeah.
But there are no stopping points in this. So, and I haven't gotten the scores yet because we're still a little bit in flux as to whether we're doing it or not. But I really enjoyed the other's experiences. And so between Michael and me, we're hopefully going to have a 45-piece orchestra mm-hmm. and make it work.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where I am.
Mm-hmm. We did a Star Wars cycle in Denver over the past couple of years with the Colorado Symphony, and there's more music in each movie. And so we finally did Return of the Jedi, and the last cue is 53 minutes long, I think, without stop. Oh, my God.
Well, I remember when I did E.T., the last, once the bicycle chase starts, it's nonstop.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of quadrupling in the horns. So I told him, put him aside, look, we get here, you drop out, and, you know, come up with a plan. And then we had two performances in one day.
Ooh.
So I told him, you have better pace yeah. yourself, because there's a lot where you sit around, you don't do anything, or you play a bit, a couple of minutes, and stop. But once you get to the bicycle chase at the end, it's nonstop. So pace yourself, because you won't have any chops left by the next day.
Yeah. The John Williams is great, but it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Great stuff, though. we did my favorite, the what's it, The Force Awakens, the suite from The Force Awakens. It's yeah. just a,
love it.
Fabulous. It's really great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the Scherzo for X-Wings. It's just all great music. Great music.
Really? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. We've covered just about all of our regular questions. I mean, we've covered so much already. Would you be okay if we moved to our last couple questions?
Whatever suits you.
Perfect.
I'm good.
Perfect. We've just got two that we end all our interviews with, Luke, if you want to.
Oh, by the way, Jeremy, anytime you want to come up to NRO, please let me know.
Yeah, I was going to say I'll reach out once I'll email you and maybe get the dates and I'd love to drive
My
up.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
You bet. My awesome. Pleasure.
Perfect. Okay, go ahead, Luke.
So one of the things that really drives me as a conductor is finding new music that people haven't heard before. Mm. Maybe it's not popular, or it just like never was published in its time. So what's the music that you really enjoy that you think a lot of people don't know about that they probably should or would probably enjoy if they actually found it?
Well, I had occasion to hear the Moszkowski Suite for two violins and piano, which is a really great piece. And I liked it so much that I orchestrated it. Mm. And it's been played a lot, actually. Vadim Gluzman and Philippe Quinn played it, which I'm really proud of. And Theodore Presser now is publishing it as of a week ago. So I'm really, really happy about that. And it's a tremendous showpiece. If you have two violinists who you like to show off, it's difficult, but it's not like impossible. It's not like learning a concerto, but I think that it's a really great piece. Let's put it that way. I remember the Bearwald Symphony Singulaire. It's a really, really great piece. He's a Swedish composer, and that particular symphony I like a lot. Theme Variations and Finale by Miklos Rocha is a piece I've done a few times. It's really, really fine. Really first class, and it's a lot of fun. He's, of course, a Hungarian composer, but one who's has his roots are very, very clear. Another piece I orchestrated was Four Hungarian Dances for clarinet and piano by Rejo Kokai. I have no idea if that's how you pronounce his name. But I heard this piece, and it's for clarinet and piano, and it's another piece that sat for 10 years before I did anything about it. But I finally orchestrated it. It's like my last performance last February with the Firewind Symphony. So we got it in just under the wire. And that's I think it's a really cool piece. It was fun to orchestrate. There are some challenges yet. And I had the good fortune in November to have a reading of it and fixed a lot of stuff for the February performance. So those are just sort of some out of the way stuff that I've run into. I'm sure if I stopped to think about it, there'd mm-hmm. be an awful lot more. Anthony Plogue is a composer of mostly brass music, but he's a dear friend, an outstanding composer. So there's a lot. I mean, you'd have to give me a few minutes to look at my library to come up with more stuff. But those are just a few of the pieces that I would totally recommend to anybody.
Okay.
They're fantastic. I mean, we've asked that question about 100 times now, and I don't even know any of those composers. Usually we get one or two that we've heard of before, but all of those are new to me.
Yeah, I can't imagine you know Kokai, quite frankly. But I could, if you have a clarinet player who it's noodly a little bit, but it's not impossible to play. And our guy did a terrific job of. I have a video of that. I have another. I keep talking about my orchestrations because most of them are pieces that are not well known that I've taken out. There's a fellow who writes phenomenal clarinet method books or studies, rather, that's a better word, called Bela Kovacs.
Yeah.
And I orchestrated the accompaniment to his Weber homage to Weber, but I also added original music as an introduction with interludes in between, much the way the Weber concertino is written.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, we did the.
It's just a few pieces.
We did the Sholem Aleichem, Ralph Feidman with our orchestra. I think last season or the season before. Yeah, it's great.
Who played it?
Boris Alekverdian. I think he's the principal in L.A. or San Francisco. One of the California symphonies.
Wow.
Yeah, he played that, and then he played this really cool piece by Alexei Shor called Verdiana, and it's three movements. Variations on Verdi melodies, but it's such a treat. It was just so much fun. Like it's like great, like pop sport classical programming, because it was super approachable, but also like a clarinet concerto. So
I played the Rigoletto fantasy.
Oh yeah,
but what this sounds like to me was even cooler.
Yeah, it was all Verdi melodies,
right,
with like South American dances. So it's a joyous little gem of a piece. It's only like 14 minutes.
Send me the name and the link. I'd love to know about it.
Yeah, I will. I will. Absolutely.
Well, I guess I stumped you on Kokai and and a few others.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks so much for being here today. Our final question is, if you could erect a billboard that all conductors would see on their way to work in the morning or outside their window, what message would you want to send out to all our listeners?
Work hard, be prepared, work well with other people, and use common sense. How's that?
Perfect.
Perfect.
It's great advice. Well, Carl, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, we'll share everything about the book. Please pre-order it. I'm going to be doing that right after we get off the phone, actually. I keep forgetting.
Yeah, let me know if there's a problem finding where the link is. I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Roman and Littlefield.
Perfect.
Great. Well, awesome. Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of Podium Time. You can find everything in the show notes below, and please reach out if you have any suggestions for guests or improvements to the podcast. We're always striving to make Podium Time the best podcast that we can for you conductors and students, so send us a Facebook message or use the contact page on our website with any suggestions you may have. Thanks so much for listening to this episode, and we'll see you next time. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligurati.